Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to another edition of Dare to Be Different. Just wonderful to have all of you tuning in, whether it's by the audio streaming, Medium Wave 1548 Satellite Islam. And there are many of you who are urging, or rather, beg your pardon, many of you are wanting to go out into the garden, we've got some wonderful advice for you, some wonderful tips that we are going to share with you this morning. And to those of you that are still curled up in bed, and others that are still having breakfast, Mohammed's laughing. Yes, many of them are still around the breakfast table, and others just taking a walk. It's been a beautiful day out on our side of the world. It's out in Gauteng. Brilliant sunshine. We've had extremities weather again after Thursday. It's been very, very hot. This morning, a lovely breeze, and we are truly, truly blessed. When we see what's happening around the world, we're truly blessed, and we've got to be grateful for all that we have. And this morning, we've got a wonderful, wonderful guest, and that's someone who's become regular with us, and we've learned so much, and so much fun to have on air with us. And she lives in one of the most beautiful parts of the country, and that's in the Knysna, and that's Andrea. Hi, good morning, Andrea.
Good morning, and how are you this morning?
Very well, thank you. I said it's always fun having you on air, and I know you live in one of those beautiful parts, and I always have to ask about the elusive, you know, Knysna elephants, because I've been reading an article and said, well, they found some of the tracks, but I'm not sure if they're still around, so I'm not sure what that means.
They are still around, but so far they have been mainly just tracks and signboards that get mangled, obviously, by elephant tusks. Couldn't have been anything else. You know, elephant footprints, elephant dung. They're very good at hiding. And of course, we've got very dense vegetation here. I read somewhere that elephants that live in a wooded environment don't get as big as elephants that live out in the grassland. So they're there somewhere, but they're very, very good at staying away from where the people are.
So do you think that the environment is camouflaging them, helping them to be camouflaged?
Yes, and long may it remain so, because there's very, very few of them left. That much we do know.
And, you know, whilst they're doing, you know, I know that there is some way they're trying to sort of number them and dart them so that they can keep track, but they haven't been very successful with that one.
I don't know. I'll have to find out and look it up. But I think the main problem has been actually finding them. I know Nature Conservation put out trip cameras, you know, tripwire cameras, out in the deep forest, and they managed to get a shot of a foot and a tusk. So they're out there, but whether they'll actually find them to follow them, I don't know.
Well, whatever it is, you know, they're elusive, but they definitely have the mystique around them. You know, it's become something like when you go on to go to Scotland, we know that Loch Ness does not, you know, it's not there, but it's still around. But here we have something more, you know, something more tangible. We're talking about our elusive elephants out in Knysna. Andrea, you know that the weather has been very, very hot in the last couple of days in our part of the world. Temperatures peaked about over 30 on Thursday, and Friday is extremely hot. Today it's slightly cooler. It's now become, you know, sort of the right time. Everyone urgent to go out in the garden. People are waiting. And some of us like us, you know, wanting to be extremely hot before we can go out into the garden. And a question that was posed to me is garden therapeutic? Is there any value to do gardening? Isn't it just better to just go out and buy things and get things from, you know, the supermarket around the corner or from your green grocer or so? Because there's so many of them, so abundant. Why do you have to really go out in the garden?
Well, you know, actually there's been a lot of research done about that in the medical fraternity, and they've actually come up with some quite positive things. The one was a test they did on stress relief. Gardening is a form of stress relief. And what they did was they had a group of people which they gave a very stressful task to. And then they said, okay, half of the group can go and read a book, and the other half will go and garden for 30 minutes, just 30 minutes. And then after that, they tested their stress levels. And interestingly, the group that were in the garden for 30 minutes were in better mood, and they were fresher, and their attention level was better, and they had lower levels of stress than the people who had sat reading a book. Then in another piece of research where they worked with mental health patients, specifically people with clinical depression or bipolar disorder, and this study was conducted in Norway, they had a group of patients do gardening for 6 hours a week, just 6 hours a week. And then after 3 months, they found that the participants who were working in the garden all had much less depression symptoms and much less symptoms of psychosis. So that's a very interesting one as well. And then, of course, there's physical exercise. You get out in your garden and you start digging and bending and stretching, then you're really busy getting yourself a good, healthy workout. And, of course, most of us have these days sedentary jobs. We sit on a chair, we sit in an office in front of a computer, or whatever it may be. And not all of us get the kind of exercise that we should be getting. In fact, they say that most of us actually don't get the kind of exercise we should be getting. And of course, for the ladies, we all like losing weight. So exercise is an important part of that as well. And then again, they also talked about brain health. And apparently they did some research that on people in their, elderly people in their 60s and 70s, and they found that people who gardened had a 36 to 47% lower risk of developing dementia or Alzheimer's disease. So that's very, very interesting too. And then, of course, nutrition. The food that you get out of your garden is fresh. It's full of nourishment. The food that you buy in the supermarket, most of it has been picked quite a long time before. Some of it may have been shipped long distances in cold storage. Some of it, they even keep it so that it's not ripened. They keep it in a situation where it won't ripen until you want it, and then they ripen it, so that can mean long, long periods in cold storage. So a lot of the food that you get in the veggie shop isn't actually all that fresh, whereas you know when you go out into your garden and you harvest something out of your garden, it's fresh and it's full of vitamins and nutrition. The longer you store something, the more the vitamins break down, the less nutritious the food becomes. So there's a whole bunch of benefits for you already.
Well, you know, looking at all of that, what you've said definitely is therapeutic, and the argument is that whilst it is cheaper, or maybe, you know, you could go and pop into your supermarket and get what you want to, but the benefits, you know, that you have from gardening, you know, is far superior to any of that, so that argument doesn't...
I'd actually argue that it's cheaper to grow your own veg. Obviously, there is a bit of a time investment in there, but, I mean, you're going to enjoy gardening. So that's enjoyment time. We don't grudge that. And, you know, you buy a packet of seeds. I mean, it's ridiculous how much they give you in a packet of seeds. If I buy, for example, a packet of spinach seed, I'll throw a half to a quarter of a packet at a time, because they give you so many. There's actually such a bounty in there. And what does a retail packet of seed cost you nowadays? Well, of course, it depends also on the hybrid you buy. Some of them you buy and you just get three seeds. I've got the habit of sort of sealing the packet to try and work up how many seeds am I getting. I like the ones that I can get a couple of sowings off a couple of weeks apart. So about 6 weeks apart, and then you've got a constant harvest going. And all of that for 15 rand. You can have tomatoes enough to be self-sufficient on tomatoes, if nothing else, in a very small space. And then you can freeze and keep that over the winter, make your own tomato and onion sort of puree and store that. So I actually feel that it's much more cost-effective to do your own veggie gardening.
And the argument that they have is that, you know, that space is at a premium and we don't always have the space, but you don't have to necessarily, you know, plant in onto the ground. You could plant in containers. Is that right?
That's right, and you can go vertical as well. Vertical gardening is the big move because people have got small gardens. If you, for example, have a vibrocrete wall, you can put netting up against that, and that can be for your beans and your peas in winter. And then, of course, there's also the vertical gardening where you use stacked containers which are attached to a vertical frame, and then you can actually go up instead of going sideways with your garden. And then, of course, also the cultivars you choose. Obviously, if you've got a small garden, you're not going to grow pumpkins because it's going to take up your whole garden if you try and grow pumpkins. But you can grow tomatoes. You can grow lettuce. Lettuce doesn't take up much space at all. There's so many things that you can do. Beetroots are actually quite pretty, and you can grow them as sort of an edging. Radishes, oh, and they are so rewarding. They, for me, they're sort of instant gratification veg. You sow them now, a couple of weeks later, they're already starting to swell, and you've got these fresh. The flavor is just incredible when they come so fresh out of the garden. They don't take up much space at all. So there are a lot of ways of doing it. Mix in your vegetables with your ornamentals if you'd rather not have a dedicated vegetable garden. And you can have a lot of fun and get quite a lot of food out of quite a small space.
Question coming through, you know, we have these young children whose thumbs seem to be stronger than any part of their body at the moment. You're always, you know, busy with their cell phones. How do we get them out into the garden?
Well, you know, I think we all, I was actually remembering, I'm busy sort of writing, it's a sort of a side project of mine. I'm busy writing about my experiences with plants, and I had to start right back in my childhood. And I think, you know, a lot of it comes from watching the plants grow. If the parents garden, the kids are more likely to garden. They're more likely to be interested in watching things grow. I think setting an example is an important thing. Also making gardening a fun activity rather than a chore. I recall that mowing the lawn was my least favorite activity. But I used to get a little bit of extra pocket money when I did that. And so, of course, that made it worth my while. And then, you know, as a birthday present, I was once given seeds and a little trowel and a little spade. And I went on this little adventure in gardening under the guidance of my grandmother. And to me, it was a very magical experience to watch the seeds grow. I think children have a lot of curiosity. And yes, they do love their video games. Whether that's a good or a bad thing, I think most people say it's a bad thing. But I think in moderation, it can help to stimulate their minds and improve their coordination. But they also do still like going outdoors. So I think it's a matter of just getting them there, encouraging them to be there, making it fun. There's one thing that I read about, for example, encourage your kids to make a teepee in the garden with climbing plants like jasmine or something like that. Kids love a little hideaway place in the garden. They could make a little pyramidal structure and train creepers up there and have a little secret place where they can sit with their friends and play. So there are a lot of ways that one can make gardening fun.
And what about those moms who do not want their children to get themselves dirty? Don't want dirty marks, dirty feet, muddy feet, you know, and all of that.
Hose them down before they come into the house.
I like that one. I like that tremendously.
You know, you get these kids that can... I remember when I was a kid, you get these kids that can play in the mud and they never get dirty. And I was always the one who I would be mud from head to toe. And as I say, that was my mother's strategy. Hose them down before I get into the house. But no, actually not quite as bad as that. Chew the tap, rinse me off, guide me through the house. Maybe it's a good idea to have old clothes handy and old shoes handy for gardening activities. You don't want them out there in their very best clothes and their shiny shoes. They will get ruined.
Well, thank you very much. I think we have enough about what the benefits of gardening. Definitely it is very therapeutic, very, very therapeutic. You know, it is that sacred space where you can go out there and be all by yourself, your thoughts, and you can do so many things that whilst you're gardening, you know, you have time for reflective moments. And I think that's what's so important about gardening. You don't have those intrusions, you don't have those, you know, other challenges that you'd have with other types of activity. Here you are in your garden all by yourself, and then you have those wonderful fragrances perhaps wafting by, and you have all this wonderful green around you, and I think that is enough to stimulate the mind.
Yes, it is. And you never get tired of it. Your garden changes with the seasons. You know, you walk around your garden, you see the different blooms coming out, and you think, oh, it's nearly so-and-so's birthday. I do a birthday calendar by flowers.
Oh, that's lovely. Now, Andrea, you know, talking about, you know, the health benefits of gardening, I've also had a query about health benefits and some of the healing plants that we have. Now, would all herbs or would all healing plants be classified as herbs, or do you have herbs and healing plants that could be separate as well?
Well, it depends on how you look at the definition. I think some people would say herb would have to be, if you're talking now in botanical terminology, a herb would be a soft plant, a little plant with sort of greeny stems, not a lot of wood on it and so on. But if you were to look in the broader sense, I think the way that most people see it when using the language rather than scientific terminology, any plant that can be used in, for culinary use, a cosmetic use, or a medicinal use could be classed as a herb. It's one of those yes and no questions.
Okay, once we've got that out of the way, now we do have, you know, lots of people who are planting for culinary uses, and we have them, you know, and I think we've gone through some of them a couple of weeks ago where you would perhaps, if you know that you're going to use a certain type of a herb in your dishes regularly, you plant all of that. And if you know you can do, for example, the Italian dishes and so forth, and you know, well, you need the thyme, you need the rosemary, and you need all of those type of herbs. Now, what about the healing herbs, the herbs that heal? Is this a specific list that people could keep? Now, we've done, I know that there are some that people say you should have in your garden because these would help, you know, in a number of instances in your home when you have these particular herbs.
Well, you know, actually the culinary herbs and the medicinal herbs you can almost see as one because a lot of the culinary herbs that you use in your kitchen are actually things that you can get a lot of health benefits from. So, for example, we can speak of rosemary. Rosemary has a wonderful effect on calming the stomach, boosting the appetite. You can use it as a cosmetic herb. It can be used to prevent dandruff if you make a nice hair rinse out of it. Plus, it leaves your hair very nice and very shiny. Basil that you use for your Italian dishes, very calming to the stomach if you've got stomach cramps or if you're tending to bloat or something like that. Put some fresh basil leaves in water. Let that steep a little bit and then drink that up. And you'll immediately feel the calming effect on your stomach. Coughs and colds, you can use basil leaf to soothe your throat. You can even make a facial scheme for your headache using either rosemary or basil or both. They're one of the ones, if you've got a really nasty headache, you put a few leaves into boiling water, throw a towel over your head and breathe in that steam. It helps to clean out your sinuses and so on, and it could help you with your headache. Going back to basil again, it even has antibiotic properties, so they say. So a lot of your culinary herbs are also medicinal herbs. And I would say that the ones that you need to have in your garden, the must-have culinary herbs, all have excellent medicinal uses. Sage is another example. Sage is wonderful also again for respiratory tract infections and so on. Also good for calming the stomach. Then again, mint. Mint is also very, very good for coughs and colds and for soothing sore throats. So the things that you have in your garden, it's just good to study up on the uses because you might not need to introduce more plants into your garden just because you want to make a tonic for a sore tummy or because you want to make something nice that smells nice in your house or whatever. It's all there already. And there's so many uses for these herbs that you really just need to look into them, the ones that everyone has in their garden. I think about lavender, for example. Lavender is wonderful as a calming tea. It's also very nice as a hair rinse, similar to the rosemary. And you can stuff little pillows with it. Some people say if you put that, you have a little stuffed pillow with rosemary, with lavender in, and you put it under your pillow, you'll sleep better at night. You can make lovely scented herbal oils. Just get a nice carrier oil, usually a transparent white oil. For example, almond oil, which you do not take internally because this is now for cosmetic use. Put your buds of your lavender flower or your rosemary or whatever fragrance you're looking to capture into that bottle. Put it on a sunny windowsill. Leave it for 48 hours. Mash it up a bit. Strain it. Put more fresh flowers in. Close it. Put it in the sun again for 48 hours. You'll repeat this 3 or 4 times. And every time, mash up the flowers nicely so that you get as much of the fragrance in as possible. And you will get a wonderful, wonderful scented oil within about, I would say, about a week of repeating this process. Sounds like a lot of trouble, but it isn't really. And it's so pretty when you package it up as a gift or something like that. People can add it to their bath for a lovely, relaxing bath. All of these herbs have relaxing scents that help you to really, really melt away into your bath. You can even take fresh branches and put that in. But obviously the oil is nicer. And you can add the oil to your existing creams to add a little bit of extra fragrance to them. So there's a lot of things you can do with the sort of plants that everybody already has in their garden.
Thank you very much for that. I think it's been very, very useful. And when you talk about them, there's so much that we already have. Because many a garden would have a rosemary and a basil and a sage and a mint. And, you know, those would be the traditional ones that people would have in the garden. And I know that people say, but I don't know how to use them. I've got them in my garden. I'm not sure how to use them. I've got the sage. What do? I know I get the beautiful flowers out of the sage. I know that perhaps the only thing that I can get out of rosemary is perhaps when I'm doing a braai and it gives me a lovely fragrance. But I don't know. And yeah, I think you've given us a number of other ways of using some of the existing herbs that we have, both as culinary as well as medicinal. The question I have had is with regards to parsley. Parsley seems to be a very difficult herb to grow. And why is that so? And what are the best conditions to grow parsley under?
Okay, parsley. Parsley likes quite cool, damp conditions. I like to actually grow it in partial shade. Excuse me, I'm going to have to cough. Pardon me. You need normally cool, moist, damp conditions. I like to say not quite in full sun for your parsley. I think the main problem I have with parsley is the germinating the seeds. The moss curled is quite difficult. That's very nice, fluffy parsley. I find the Italian parsley a lot easier to grow than its curly little friend. And then also the other thing you do have to look out for a little bit is pests. And we're going to be a little bit later in the program, hopefully, discussing a nice insecticidal spray that you can use on all of your plants and that you can make in your kitchen, and that's non-toxic. So I would like to say, listeners, please keep a pen and paper handy, because that could also help you along with your policy.
Question coming through. I planted celery about 8 months ago. It's growing prolifically. Do I have to cut it down, or does celery continue year in and year out?
Well, look, it's not immortal. It lasts about 2 years usually. So, but do pick as much as you like. It seems to like being picked. So make use of it. Remember, you can also dry your parsley, spread it out on a clean sheet of paper, and let it dry nicely and slowly in a shady place, and then cut it up fine and bottle it. So then you've also got it at times when your plants aren't doing so well, or you can give it away to friends. I always say vegetable gardening, it's like a big network, and it's all about giving. You always have surplus. You always have abundance. So then you give away what you're not going to use to your friends, and hey, maybe one day they've got something too much and they give you some back. So it's all about giving and receiving.
So celery could be dried up and you don't have to use the leaves. Do you have to use the leaves, or can you use everything? I think that's the question coming through as well.
Oh, you can definitely use the leaves. The stalk, the leaves. I always like adding the leaves to soups and stews. It gives it a sort of quite a nice salty-ish flavor. And with the drying out, you would want to dry leaves rather than the stalks. Obviously, the stalks very nice fresh for salads. And then I use the leaves in cooking. I put them into soups, stews, stir fries. They give a nice flavor.
Thank you very much. I think it's time for us to go for the news. When we come back, we'll continue. And like you said, we have so much more to chat about. Take care.
Absolutely.
Did you know that gardening is the fastest growing hobby in the world? Islam highly recommends planting trees and urges people to protect them, to the extent that planting a tree is considered as an act of worship, for which special prayer is recommended. The Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, "Unless you are compelled, do not cut down a tree." So join Ismail Pariyava every Sunday between 8:30 and 9:30 a.m. on the program Dare to Be Different.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Yes, Dare to Be Different. My name is Ismail Pariyava. Just wonderful to have all of you tuning in, whether it's via the audio streaming, medium wave 1548 in Satellite Islam. And we have a wonderful guest, and it's Andrea out in the beautiful part of the country, and she's sharing some wonderful ideas. Remember, you could join our conversation. You could dial in 854-1548 with any queries, any questions, or you can send me a message on 073-461-3014, 073-461-3014. Hi, Andrea, are you back again?
Yes, back and ready to go.
Thank you very much. I've got a query that's come to Andrea. I have a cycad with yellow marks on the leaves. What can I do?
Oh, that's probably thrips. It's a little like white ticks or yellow. It's a little thrips.
Hello. Sorry, Andrea. I'm not sure if I can hear you. Hello, Andrea. I think we've lost Mohammed. Have we lost Andrea? Mom is just trying to get. I'm not too sure if we've lost Andrea. Remember the number to dial 854-1548. Any queries, any questions, and if you have any particular queries, do join our conversation. This morning, we've been talking about herbs, and Andrea has spoken about both medicinal as well as culinary herbs and their wonderful uses. And there's so much that we can do with the herbs that we have. Maybe not too sure how to use them, and she's given some ideas of the different herbs. Spoke about the rosemary, basil, sage, mint, and also spoke about having to make some lovely oils. And I think that is an exciting project if you're wanting to get into. A wonderful idea to be able to use those particular herbs in these oils. Hi, Andrea.
Hi again. We're going to be talking about the spots on the cycad. Right?
Yes, it says it's yellow marks on the cycad, on the leaves. What can I do? What should I do?
The chances are that you had a little scratchy insect. They're called thrips. They're very nasty. They're quite difficult to get rid of. So I would recommend that you get these oil emulsion sprays that you can get at any Life is a Garden Center. They're non-toxic. And what they do is they actually smother the little nasty insects. So I would then recommend that you spray that cycad probably for once a week for about a month should do the job.
Okay, and what's that particular product called, Andrea?
There are various ones. You can get a canola oil emulsion that's designed for spraying on plants, or you can get a light mineral oil there's several products. So just hop on along and say you'd like an oil emulsion to spray insects with. And the nice thing about that is it's broad spectrum. So you're not going to just get it for your spots and your cycad. You can use it to smother aphids. If you find aphids on your plants, it's non-toxic. You don't have to worry about your kids, your pets, yourself. You don't even have to really wear gloves because it's complete.
I think we seem to be having some difficulty with the line this morning, and that was Andrea giving us some ways of getting rid of the yellow marks on the leaf of a cycad by a broad-based one, a sort of emulsion, a canola emulsion or any other one, and that will be available at any of the garden centres. You spray that and that would hopefully get rid of that particular problem. So that is a particular emulsion that you could buy from any of the garden centres. We're going to be talking about some of the sprays as well, and like Andrea said, have your pens and paper and take down that particular recipe. It's something that we could use on our foods in our gardens, and she's going to share that with us this morning. Mom has got her back online. Andrea, sorry about that this morning. Hello, Andrea.
I think it might be the weather here. We've got some lovely rain and some very thick clouds, but it might be interfering with my signal.
Okay, that's fine. Don't worry about it. Andrea, we've spoken about, you know, we're going to share some of those recipes that you said we could, you know, that we can do this morning. Now, when we have lots of our, you know, plants and we seem to be having infected, what is the best way to control them?
Well, you can buy chemicals, obviously, if you're lazy. You can just zoot down to your garden center. I've got this or that problem. Take a leaf along, because a good horticulturist will be able to tell you exactly what insect it is. But you can also prevent and repel insects and even kill them with some things that you can find in your kitchen, which is a really good thing to do. So I would like to say, have your pen and your pencil ready, because here comes my recipe. It works. I've used it in a wholesale nursery. There are a few pests that won't control, but the majority of them it either controls or repels to the point where they don't want to eat it anymore. It's completely non-toxic, and you can make it in your own kitchen at home. What you need is 10 to 12 large cloves of garlic. Then you need 4 to 6 hot chili peppers. Hot ones, note. You want jalapenos or you want cayenne or something that's really hot. And you can use dried or fresh chilies. Alternatively, you can use cayenne pepper, a level teaspoon, to replace each chili. So in other words, then 4 to 6 level teaspoons of cayenne pepper or chili powder. Then you want 2 cups of water, nice big cups of water, and about a tablespoon of sunlight liquid. Sunlight liquid on its own, I'm sure many listeners will know, is an insecticide. It does also work on the same principle as that oil we were discussing, in that it actually smothers the insect and also breaks down the little layer on the outside of them. They've got a waxy layer that protects them from the environment and prevents them from dehydrating. So that's an important component. So let's run through it again. 10 to 12 large cloves of garlic, 4 to 6 hot chilies, note, or else 4 to 6 level teaspoons of chili powder or cayenne pepper, one or the other. And then 2 cups of water and a tablespoon of liquid sunlight soap. Now, chop everything up fine. Well, obviously you can't chop the soap, it's a liquid already, but your garlic and your chilies, you chop up as fine as you can. If you've got a blender, then just put everything in the blender and run it through the blender. But before you add the soap, because otherwise you end up with a lot of foam. And then once you've got all your finely chopped chilies and garlic, you add your soap, you add your water, and you leave that to steep for about... You can leave it overnight, but I prefer 48 hours. 48 hours, it really takes all the good stuff out of the ingredients. Now you want to strain it, because you don't want to block your spray bottle's nozzle when you spray. So strain it through cloth. You can get muslin, light cloth, any light cloth. The dish cloth will even do, but it's a bit slow because the cloth is a bit heavy. And strain out all the bits. Press it out with a spoon or something to make sure you get as much of the juice as possible through. Now you have a concentrate. So your mixture that you've got here is going to go a long, long way. You can store it in a plastic bottle. Never please something with a metal top, plastic or glass. But a metal lid will get eaten up by the chili, and you don't want that happening. Right, so now how do you use it? Take 2 tablespoons of concentrate to a litre bottle of water. You can get these little litre hand spray bottles just about anywhere. Get one that makes a very nice fine spray, adjustable spray that you can turn the nozzle and get a really fine spray, because the littler the drop is, the better it sticks to the plant. The sunlight liquid is also going to help to make this stick to the plant. So now you've mixed 2 tablespoons of your concentrate with 1 liter of water. Spray that on your plant. Get good coverage. Try and spray under the leaves, on top of the leaves, everywhere. And that will repel a lot of insects, and the ones that it doesn't repel, it will kill. Except for the one exception is the thrips, unfortunately, which was eating our friend's cycad. They kind of like garlic, but they're an exception. Most insects don't like the smell of garlic. They think, oh, wow, this is gross. I'm not going to eat this. No way. And they go somewhere else, which is great for you. And it's especially good with moths. They've done scientific trials where they've shown that the moths actually get confused. They use scent signals to choose a plant to lay their eggs on. And obviously after the moth comes the worms. So you don't want the moth laying his eggs there, or her eggs. The moth gets confused. It doesn't recognize the plant at all. And it goes away. It goes and lays its eggs somewhere else. The chili directly kills things. It burns them to death, basically, which is quite cool and so on. But I suppose you want to get rid of aphids and things like that. And, of course, then the sunlight soap, 2 things that it does. It makes the repellent insecticide that you've made stick to the plant. And also it helps to kill some of the insects. It helps to actually smother them. So you'll be applying this probably around about once a week. If it's rained, obviously your mix is washed off and you need to spray again. And I would only really use this in plants that are a problem or times of the year when there is a problem. At this time of the year, for instance, we get a lot of caterpillars. It's that time of the year when the moths are laying the eggs and the caterpillars are about. Spring and autumn seem to be the big times for caterpillars. Unfortunately, if the caterpillars are young, then this spray will actually even kill them right on the spot. Otherwise, it repels your insects. Fantastic thing to do. Then you also get fungal diseases that affect plants. And for this, you can use ordinary milk. 1 part milk to 9 parts water. Spray that on. It controls a wide range of fungal diseases. But the main thing that it does is it prevents the little seed of the fungus, the spore of the fungus, from germinating. If you already have an infection, you might have to try something a little more drastic, like a copper spray or something like that. Again, then you'd be going to your co-op or to your garden center. But if you know that it's a time of the year, for example, if it's been raining a lot and you've got pumpkin plants, you know they're going to be getting downy or powdery mildew. Mildew is a big problem with pumpkins. If you use your milk spray as a preventative, then the spores can't germinate and your plant doesn't get sick in the first place. These things work. They have been used for hundreds of years, and people are now discovering, even researchers, the milk thing they researched in South America on vegetables again, and they found that it controlled a wide range of fungi when used as a preventative spray. So there's some nice things you can do without risking any poison in your garden.
Thank you very much for those. So the one is the chili spray. So you've got, I'm going to repeat the recipe, 10 to 12 large cloves of garlic, 6 hot chili or 6 level teaspoons of cayenne pepper. What happens if you decide to take both of them? Would it make it more potent?
Well, it's really potent, and your garden will smell very nice.
And then you said 2 cups of water. And one tablespoon of liquid, sunlight liquid, I think. And then you steep this for 48 hours. Is that correct?
Okay. That's correct, and that's your concentrate. So then you strain it out, and you use about 2 tablespoons to a liter of water, and voila, you've got a brilliant pest-repelling, pest-killing spray. It even works on red spider mite.
And I suppose it lasts for quite a while, because you're making quite a large quantity, so it would keep maybe for about 3 or 4 months, depending how much you're wanting to use. Is that correct? Could you keep it for that amount of time?
Yes, you can, as long as you store it in a cool, dark place.
Okay, so that could be. And then the other one you've given us was 1 part of milk to 9 parts of water. You mix the 2, and then you could use that as a spray as well.
That's right. That's for your fungal diseases that are not insects. You can't see them, but you get all these funny spots and stripes on your plants and on your fruits.
I've got a question that's come through. I've got an indoor plant, and it's got all the white mealybug stuff. Could I use this particular, any one of these on that?
Yes, I would suggest for the mealybug the oil spray. But what I would suggest you do before you start treating the leaves is just tap your pot lightly so that the whole soil ball loosens up, if it's possible. If it's a big pot, obviously that can be a problem. But then if it's a big pot, I would suggest scratch a little bit. Look and see if there's white stuff in the soil. If there's white stuff in the soil, then it's actually already begun to affect the roots. And in that case, you need to take a really violent approach. Let's say worst-case scenario, you have discovered that these white insects have got down into the roots of your plant as well. Then what you will have to do is actually take your plant, your whole plant out, gently bash the soil. If you can say gently bash, I don't know if that's possible. Gently bash the soil ball. People are often too tender with their plants, you know. Bash the soil ball so that all the soil comes off the roots. Rinse the roots in water and try and get rid of all of the white insects. If there are a lot of them sucked onto the roots, then you might want to actually dip them in your oil mixture that you've made. You buy the concentrate and then you mix it with water and let that soak a little while just to kill them. That's worst case scenario. If they're not in the soil, then I would recommend again the oil mixture. And then with either of these, the chili or the garlic or the oil mixture, always spray late in the afternoon so that you don't get direct sun on the plant directly after you've sprayed it, because in that case it can burn. So you don't want that to happen. So do it when it's got a night to dry off and so on. And that will help to get rid of this. With that little white insect, remember to go into the leaf bases. You know, your leaves are gripped onto the stem in a certain way. And this particular nasty little insect is quite difficult to get hold of because it likes to hide away. Hides away in roots, not always. In a bad infestation it will. Or it hides away in the leaf bases. So in that case you want to really make sure that your spray is penetrating into the leaf bases. That's also why I like the oil spray for that one, because the oil penetrates. If you think about it, you've got something that's really rusty, you get some of that Q20, you spray it on and it somehow manages to penetrate in there. Now I'm not recommending Q20 for plants, but these oil-based plant insecticides do actually penetrate into the leaf bases and help to kill off those things. You'll probably have to repeat spray once a week or so for about a month, just to get rid of all the babies and so on, because they pack onto one another. And then the outer ones get affected by your spray, but not the ones that are hiding under their friends.
Now, something about these two recipes that you've given, it's not just a one-off thing. It has to be done continuously for a couple of weeks. Is that correct?
Well, yes. If you're going to get, obviously water on your leaves is going to tend to rinse it off. So I would say, well, I've used it in a situation where we had irrigation, and we used to do it once a week. Even with the irrigation, it was okay. So once a week, I would say, is good. If you actually have a problem, once a week, I'd say, is a repellent. And then if you have a problem, then I would say, go up to every second day if you want to try and get rid of an actual problem. But then you can also monitor your pest population. If it's something like aphids, you can clearly see whether your spray has killed it. Sometimes one spray will do it. Sometimes it's maybe just good, even after you think they're all dead, to just do one follow-up spray. But take a look with your eyes, take a little magnifying glass as well, and have a look, see if you see nunus.
The question that normally or regularly crops up is one with regards to curry leaf. You know, you have the infestation of the curry leaf, and you have the leaves curling up. Or would this particular recipe work for that?
Yes. The leaf curl, unfortunately, is probably caused either by prior insect damage or by, and this is a worst-case scenario, a virus that gets transmitted into the plant by an insect. And if your plant has obtained a virus, it's never going to get better, sorry. But usually it's insect damage. The insects irritate the leaves when they're young and then they curl. So with your leaf curl, yes, the chili and garlic I would use for that one, because it could be red spider mite or it could be aphids. And either one of those, the chili and garlic spray, will work.
Thank you very much for that. I've got another query that's come through. I'm wanting to continue planting, my petunias. Is it a good time?
Petunias?
Mm-hmm.
Petunias are fantastic. You know, you can do them in winter, you can do them in summer. They don't tolerate very harsh frost, but they actually quite like the summer weather. They're pretty much year-round color. So I would say, I know certainly in Gauteng, if that's where you are, I know certainly here where I am in the Western Cape, they can be grown year-round, and summertime is actually one of the best times. My little tip with petunias, pinch off your earliest flowers. I know this sounds horrible, but what you actually want to do is you want to get as many branches out of that little crown of your petunia as possible. So I find that pinching out the tips as soon as they've stitched out long enough to do so, and even if that tip has got a flower on, means that you will get more flowers, better flowers later on.
What about planting in a shady or a deep shaded spot?
Planting what?
Any color, one's color in any color, beg your pardon, it says color in a deep shade or shady spot.
A color plant, colorful plant.
Mm-hmm.
Well, obviously your New Guinea impatiens is always a good choice for if you want bright color and for the summertime. They even sometimes pull through the winter and flower again. So yes, definitely the New Guinea impatiens, a very, very good choice. In the old days we used to do the busy lizzies, but unfortunately there came a nasty disease through there. I see them appearing again, so I don't know if they've bred a disease-resistant cultivar or just whether the disease pressure's down. You might even be lucky to be able to get busy lizzies again. And then, of course, bright color for deep shade. Well, wintertime, you'll want your primulas. They're very easy, and they self-seed every year, so you'll get them year after year after year. Summertime, if you're going annuals, definitely the New Guineas. And summertime, well, you know, if you're happy to have perennials that flower at different times of the year, you can sort of research it a little bit and choose different perennials and bulbs that flower at different times of the year. Obviously, clivias round about now, they're actually sort of doing their last big fanfare here in the Western Cape. Your plectranthus that flower in spring and autumn and then basically through the winter. Plectranthus generally flower at any time when the day length is longer than 12 hours. So obviously they're not summer things. They're spring, autumn, winter. And then of course you can also go for variegated foliage. Again, more for the low maintenance approach because the annuals and so on, they're hard to work. However, if you've got a smaller garden, by all means, go ahead. And as I say, they're the number one colorful plant is the New Guinea impatiens at this time of year.
Thank you very much. And I think the last question that we're going to take for this morning is it time for us to do seeds, or can we buy? Is it better to buy seedling for food growing?
You can still sow a lot of things from seed. I would stay away from your cucurbits. So in other words, all your pumpkin-y things and your squashy things, they should have been started already. You might take a chance with ordinary gem squash. You might still get a good crop with them. You might still get a good crop of baby marrows. But I definitely stay away from pumpkins. Then your tomatoes, definitely. You've still got a great growing season going for tomatoes. Spinach is perfect, no problem. Carrots, no problem. Beetroots, no problem. So yes, you can still start a lot of things from seed. But also, if you don't really have a lot of faith in yourself, then you can also buy the 6 and 12 packs or whatever from your nursery. Personally, I prefer sowing the seeds. It's cheaper and you get more out of it.
Andrea, you know, if you're planting them and you're doing them from seed, how should you spread them out? Every 2 weeks, you know, sow them, or should you sow them week after week? What would be sort of a good guideline?
I suppose it would really depend on how many vegetables your family eats. For me, about every 6 to 8 weeks is a good spacing out for sowing, because, you know, you're going to be harvesting off of your plants that you've grown for a fairly considerable amount of time. You don't want too many things ripening at the same time. So I like to spread out about every 6 to 8 weeks, but you can try it out yourself and see if you think you should be doing it more often. Something like radishes, because they're so quick, I wouldn't space them more than every 4 weeks because they're so fast. But other things I would definitely go with the 6 to 8 weeks, maybe even a bit more.
Well, thank you very much, Andrea. Unfortunately, we've run out of time this morning, as usual. You know, we think we just get so many things done, but we don't. But there's another opportunity. We'll chat to you again soon. But thank you for sharing all that information. You have a wonderful time, and I'm sure you're going to enjoy the beautiful weather out on that side once it clears up. And that's all from us. Until we meet again, you take care.
You too. Thanks for the chat.
Thanks, now. Bye-bye. And that was Andrea Durham talking to us from the beautiful part of the country that's out in the Western Cape, I beg your pardon, Southern Cape, and that's towards Knysna. And she's given us some wonderful, wonderful tips this morning. And remember that if you have any queries, any questions, you could send that through the week. And as soon as we have a guest on a Sunday, we'd ask them help us along with those particular queries. That's all from me. Until we meet again, inshallah. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.